Thank you for listening to this podcast from TRE, Talk Radio Europe, your voice in Spain and around the world. For more information, please visit tre.radio.
The TRE Book Show is sponsored by audible.co.uk. Download one title each month, plus unlimited listening to thousands of Audible originals, podcasts, and audiobooks. Just click on the Audible banner at www.tre.radio.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Good evening. Welcome to tonight's book show. As always, we'll start by looking at the bestseller lists on Amazon.co.uk and the Sunday Times, the oldest and most influential book sales chart in the UK, checking out what new entries there are. Then we'll be catching up with Guy Lloyd, the international sales manager at Penguin Random House. He joins us once a month to talk all things books. This month, he's looking at what the UK general election means for publishing, whether men only buy books written by other men, some exciting books that are due out this autumn, and a tribute to Michael Moseley. Also chatting to Irenosun Okoje, MBE. She's a Nigerian-British writer whose debut novel Butterfly Fish was shortlisted for an Edinburgh International First Book Award. A fellow and vice chair of the Royal Society of Literature, she's the co-presenter of the BBC Novels That Shaped Our World podcast, Turn Up for the Books. Her second novel, Curandera, explores the darker elements of shamanism, desire, betrayal, and friendship across time and dimensions. We're also chatting to Robert Trigoning, who's appeared in West End shows like Charlie and the Chocolate Factory and Matilda the Musical. His children's picture book, The Dress in the Window, was inspired by his husband Billy and his childhood memory of falling in love with a dress in a shop window. It's a powerful celebration of imagination, parental love, and being true to yourself. He wrote the book to celebrate difference and to encourage young people to feel free to express themselves. The book, along with three others, has been picked by independent bookshops across the UK as the best books of the summer, winning this year's Indie Book Awards and running as part of Independent Bookshop Week, which was the 15th to the 22nd of June. That's just the first hour. In the second hour, we chat to Joe Thomas, Dan Flanagan, Gay Maris, and Karen Fitzgibbon.
The Book Programme. Presented by Hannah Murray.
I am unwritten, can't read my mind, I'm undefined. I'm just beginning, the pen's in my hand. Before you open up the dirty window, let the sun illuminate the words that you could not find. Reaching for something in the distance, so close you can almost taste it. Release your inhibitions, feel the rain on your skin. No one else can feel it for you, only you can let it in. No one else, no one else can speak the words on your lips. Trace yourself in words unspoken. Live your
Good evening. Welcome to tonight's book show. We start by looking at the Sunday Times bestseller list, the oldest and most influential book sales chart in the UK, and the one that every author wants to be on. The chart is the most accurate and comprehensive estimation of book sales in the country. The TV presenter Michael Moseley returns to the charts for the first time since February with Just One Thing. Sales of the book have gone up by 650% over the past fortnight. Taylor Swift is topping the children's chart as the latest famous person to feature in the Little People Big Dreams series. So looking at general hardbacks, we have six new entries, including number one, D-Day, The Unheard Tapes by Geraint Jones, a history of the battle for Normandy based on more than 150 audio interviews. Number two is SAS Great Escapes 3 by Damian Lewis. Number three, MILF by Paloma Faith. Number four, a new entry, Operation Biting by Max Hastings, the story of the 1942 parachute assault on Hitler's newly identified radar network. Number five is Endgame 1944 by Jonathan Dimbleby. Number six, a new entry called How to Win a Grand Prix by Bernie Collins, a former head of race strategy at Aston Martin F1, reveals how the sport really works. Number seven, Great Britain by Torsten Bell. The Labour Party candidate for Swansea West diagnoses the issues facing Britain. Number eight is Wimbledon by Sue Barker. Number nine, Growing Wings by Ben Hunt. This is the inside story of Red Bull Racing and its domination of Formula One. And the final new entry at 10, Broken Threads by Michelle Hussein. The newsreader uncovers the story of her grandparents' lives. Moving on to fiction hardbacks, just three new entries from last week, including number one, When the Moon Hatched by Sarah A. Parker. A rebel assassin is rescued from certain death by a dragon rider. Number two, You Like It Darker by Stephen King. Number three, a new entry by Ella Fields called Nectar of the Wicked. A changeling makes a vow so she can enter the fairy realm and discover her past. Number four this week is Eruption by James Patterson and Michael Crichton. Number five, Murder at the Monastery by Richard Coles. Number six, Think Twice by Harlan Coben. Number seven is Camino Ghosts by John Grisham. Number eight, You Are Here by David Nichols. Number nine, The Midnight Feast by Lucy Foley. And number 10 is the last new entry, Nero by Con Iggulden. The story of Nero's birth and raising under the scheming eye of his mother, Agrippina. And bestsellers in books on Amazon.co.uk for this week. At number one, Pinch of Nom Air Fryer by Kay Allinson. Number two is The Fast Diet by Dr. Michael Mosley. Number three, Politics on the Edge by Rory Stewart. Number four is The Housemaid by Freda McFadden. Number five, The Housemaid is Watching by Freda McFadden. Number six, It Ends With Us by Colleen Hoover. Number seven is Ultra-Processed People by Chris Van Tulleken. Number eight, The Last Devil to Die by Richard Osman. Number nine, None of This is True, which has been voted Crime Novel of the Year 2024. That's by Lisa Jewell. And number 10 is A Court of Thorns and Roses by Sarah J. Maas.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
You're listening to The Book Club on Talk Radio Europe. And keep listening. That's an instruction from Margaret Thatcher.
Joining us on the line now is Guy Lloyd. He's the International Sales Manager for Penguin Random House and joins us once a month to talk all things books. How are you, Guy?
Very well, Hannah. Very good to be with you, as always.
Yes, lovely to have you with us. So, big news in the UK, of course, over the last few weeks or so, was the announcement of the general election coming up very, very shortly. What does that mean for publishing?
Well, yes, you might have noticed a little bit of coverage about the election. But, of course, every industry will use that as an excuse to lobby the new government, whichever colour that may be. And our industry has trade bodies like the PA, which is the Publishers Association, the BA, which is the Booksellers Association, and other bodies like the Society of Authors. And they, like in any industry, they act as lobbyists to influence legislation and funding. And of course, any lobbyist is likely to ask for more money because that's what they tend to do. But what does publishing want the money for, especially wants it for libraries? I always bang on about libraries, but library funding is really necessary to reverse all of the closures that councils have introduced in the past 14 years. Also, the size of the education budget is very important because that budget affects how many books schools can buy, both things like textbooks and for their own libraries. And of course, those are provided by publishers. So income for education also means income for publishers. Legislation will be an important part. They will ask for tighter legislation about AI, artificial intelligence, which I've mentioned before, so I won't go over the whole shooting match again, but it's basically about AI companies mining data on the internet that is copyright protected and not paying for it. And then allied with that is things like the protection of international copyright laws, which protect online use, because copyright laws were made at a time when the internet and online selling didn't exist at all. What else do they want? They would like to reduce VAT, certainly. There's a strange anomaly in publishing that physical books and newspapers are exempt from VAT, but ebooks and audiobooks are not. And I've never understood the reason for that. You either have one or not the other, preferably not at all. Mm. We don't want another 20% on the price of any reading matter, thank you. But that's kind of an administrative wrinkle that needs to be ironed out. And it also has an effect on the publishing schedules, because some publishers with politically related books have had to alter their publishing schedules to publish them before the election. So there was a book coming up called Good Chaps by Simon Cooper, who's a great author and actually wrote a brilliant book on the Dutch football team, of all things, called Brilliant Orange years ago. Good Chaps is about corruption in UK politics, so it's clearly a huge book. And Profile, the publisher, who are great independent, have brought that forward from the 29th of August to the 13th of June for obvious reasons. And also from Profile, there's a book called Democracy, 11 Writers and Leaders on What It Is and Why It Matters. And they've moved that forward a few weeks to June the 6th, so that is available now. And there's also a book from them called Democracy, which is just a general book with thoughts on democracy from big writers like Margaret Atwood and Mary Beard. And that's come forward as well. And the people I really feel sorry for in the time of an election are publicists, because that has the ability to really mess with their carefully crafted publishing schedules. Because what tends to happen is that an author who has a slot on perhaps a Radio 4 program like Today or a news program, or maybe going on television like Good Morning Britain or something like that, may have had that slot put into the schedule. Now, for publishers, that's really important. You know, national TV and radio is a huge deal. For the actual schedulers of the programs themselves, it's a movable feast. So those poor authors are always likely to be bumped by the election, because just all the coverage just gravitates towards that. The election sucks in every piece of time like this enormous black hole. So yes, there will be some frantically rewritten schedules, and also some political editors who won't be appearing at festivals due to the fact they're having to put in extra shifts for the election. So big changes and big asks all around.
I just noticed I was looking at the bestseller charts for this week and saw that Politics on the Edge by Rory Stewart was the best-selling non-fiction book of the past week.
Yeah, absolutely. And that, I'm sure, would have been in the top 10 anyway. But the election just gives it extra impetus. So I'm not surprised to see it at number one.
Yeah. An interesting topic, the idea of whether men only buy books written by other men. This is fascinating. What are your thoughts on this then?
Well, it's long been a bugbear of the publishing industry. I mean, the publishing industry is top heavy in that most books, and particularly most fiction, is bought by women. And that there is new research from something called the Women's Prize Trust, who are a charity to do with the Women's Prize for Fiction, and there is a Women's Prize for Nonfiction this year. And they've commissioned our old friends at Nielsen Book Data, who provide all our chart data, for some consumer research. And it was a very, very big sample of 54,000 book purchases last year. And it threw up an interesting couple of stats, which is of the top 20 writers of fiction and nonfiction who were women, published in 2023, and this is everybody from Agatha Christie to Colleen Hoover, fewer than 20% were bought by men. And the majority of those purchases were classics, not contemporary writers. Now, if you flip that stat round and say, right, take the top 20 men, so everybody, Orwell, James Patterson, Charles Dickens, 44% were bought by women. So 20% of men buy female books and 44% of women buy books by men. Now, only one of the top 20 women had a majority of purchase of male purchasers, and that was Harper Lee, who, of course, To Kill a Mockingbird.
Yeah.
Now, I suspect that's because it's on so many schools' reading lists that actually Dad may have gone to purchase it on his credit card for the kids for the forthcoming school year. So that's probably skewed it. Now, in order to try and counter this, there was, I mean, there have been various campaigns. There was a campaign years ago using male writers and celebrities like Salman Rushdie, Ian McEwan, Andrew Marr, Simon Mayo, and it was called Men Reading Women. But also, I think there's another fact that skews this, and this is reading groups. Most reading groups that I know are either exclusively female or predominantly female. I don't know, and I've been around in publishing a while, I don't know of any reading group that's exclusively all male. Now, there may be people shouting at the radio saying, I'm one, but if you are, good for you, but I don't know of you.
No.
So I would appeal to males generally and say, treat your reading like a diet. You know, carrots are good for you, but you're not going to have them for every meal. Simply, if all you read is thrillers and the odd bit of historical nonfiction, then if you read 10 books a year, make one or two of them by Ali Smith, Zadie Smith, Pat Barker, Elif Shafak, Bonnie Garmus, and you'll be in for a surprise and in for a treat.
Yeah. That's really important. You made me realize I've interviewed a few female authors who have given themselves a pen name that doesn't kind of let the reader know what sex she is, basically, for that very reason. They've wanted, you know, men, thriller writers, I'm talking, you know, crime fiction authors, you know, that are very much read by men and women, that the female authors haven't wanted the male readers to know that they're a woman to put them off from buying the book.
That's absolutely true. You're right. A lot of very famous writers do it. J.K. Rowling does it.
Yeah.
You know, none more famous than her, but she writes her adult crime series under, I think it's Robert Galbraith is the name that she uses. But so it's more common than we think.
Yeah, interesting. Sponsorship in the book industry.
Well, yes, I brought this up because there is what I think a rather depressing row going on that's made the national news as well about a company called Baillie Gifford. And just to give you a bit of background, so they've been around, they're a Scottish company, they're based in Edinburgh. They've been around for well over 100 years, and they are an investment management company. So they invest in a variety of companies and businesses, and they have a pretty big portfolio. But they are a long-time book sponsor, and they sponsor, amongst other things, the major non-fiction prize in the UK that's the equivalent of the Booker, and several really big book festivals, including the Hay Festival, Cheltenham, and Edinburgh. And that's really the big three. Now, on the other side of that, there is a pressure group called Fossil Free Books, who claims that Baillie Gifford have investment in companies linked, A, to the Israeli state, and B, have investments in the fossil fuel industry. And there's a pressure group led by more than 200 authors, including Sally Rooney, have signed a statement calling on them to disinvest. And they've said that if their demands are not met, they will have a commitment to disrupt future events. And Baillie Gifford, on the other side, have claimed that Fossil Free Books claims are, quote, seriously misleading. And they said of the clients that the group is targeted, the investment in Israel and is tiny compared to the context of their overall business, and they are engaging already with certain companies, and that of the fossil fuel investment, only 2% of its clients' money is invested in companies connected to fossil fuels. Now, the upshot of this pressure is that Baillie Gifford has withdrawn its sponsorship from Cheltenham, from Hay, and from Edinburgh. And they said that these festivals are the organisers are greatly saddened by this. And they pointed out that a lot of festivals rely on a mix of income, which includes corporate sponsorship. And without it, there would be no free events, ticket prices would increase, and some festivals would close. So I would put forward the claim that is everything we buy and invest in so clean? I mean, do we know exactly where our pensions are invested? Do we know that when we buy a new mobile phone, it may be using chemicals and elements that have been mined in war-torn regions like the Democratic Republic of Congo, for instance? Another problem for the industry is that prize sponsorship in the book industry isn't easy to get, and it can really ill afford to lose Bailey Gifford. So an example of that is the Whitbread Prize, who sponsored major prize for years, withdrew, and it was a while before Costa came on board, and then Costa withdrew, and it was another while before Cafe Nero came on board. So it takes a while, and sometimes it leaves a financial black hole. And a final point, I suppose, is that I think that literature and publishing in general is about representing freedom of speech. And that means having a wide range of opinion. And we should remember that that means publishing opinions that we sometimes don't like ourselves. That's the ultimate test.
Yeah.
That we can publish a book that we ourselves don't agree with. That's kind of the point for me.
Yeah, it's a very, very fascinating discussion point, isn't it? And people have very strong opinions on these things.
They do, and I can see the argument both ways, and I have respect for both parties.
Yeah,
but I think overall, it's a shame if anyone is hounded out like that.
Yeah. Let's talk about a couple of books, new books coming out this autumn, a new one by Stanley Tucci.
Yeah, let's talk about new books after I've droned on about politics and sponsorship and things. Let's talk about what we really are here for, which is the books. So Stanley Tucci, the marvellous Stanley Tucci, is publishing a new book called What I Ate in 1 Year, which is coming out.
I love it already.
I know. It's coming out on a publisher called Fig Tree on the 10th of October. Now, we know Stanley Tucci, actor, writer, director, producer, string of awards, Golden Globes, Emmys, you name it. Remember him from films like Prince's Honor, which was 1985 when I looked it up.
Wow.
Which is rather scary. And even The Devil Wears Prada, which I always think of as a very recent film, is now 18 years old.
Oh, no way.
Yeah, it's 2006, Hannah.
Wow, that is frightening, isn't it?
It really is. But what we also know about Stanley Tucci is he's a great foodie. I mean, he has cookery books and TV documentaries to his name. And he published a breakthrough book called Taste in 2022, Taste, My Life Through Food, which was a huge New York Times and Sunday Times bestseller. And this one is in a similar vein, but it records what I ate in 1 year, as it suggests, records 12 months of eating. And it's whenever he had a meal, whether that was in a restaurant, on a film set, at a freebie launch, at home, in the US, outside the US, you name it. So there are lots of reflections on himself, and it promises, I think, to be another great foodie memoir. I think the first one was brilliant. And also listen out for the audio, because he'll be reading it, I expect. And the first audio was huge as well.
Yeah. Oh, I look forward to that. Brilliant. And a new one by Sophie Kinsella.
Yes, the great Sophie Kinsella, she of Confessions of a Shopaholic, all those Shopaholic books, and The Undomestic Goddess, has written a short novella. I think it's only going to be about 140 pages, but it's called What Does It Feel Like? And that's coming out through Transworld on the 10th of October. And the plot is around a woman called Eve, who is a successful novelist. And she wakes up one day in a hospital bed with absolutely no memory of how she got there. And her husband explains that she's had an operation to remove a brain tumor. And of course, from that point on, her whole life is reassessed. So it's a fairly strong subject, but it's one that I'm sure almost anyone can identify with. And knowing Sophie Kinsella, it will be done with her trademark wit and humor, as they say. And there's an interesting quote from her, which says that the book is fiction, but it's my most autobiographical work to date. Eve's story is my story. And that follows on from the fact that she announced in April that she'd had a diagnosis of a particularly rare form of brain cancer. So we not only wish her well with the book, but we especially wish her well with the treatment.
Yes. Oh, wow. I don't think I read that. I look forward to reading that book as well then. Thank you. And, of course, we have to mention a tribute to now, sadly, the late Michael Moseley. Lots of his books have been in the bestseller charts the last couple of weeks since he sadly passed away in Greece.
Well, that's true. And, yes, it is difficult to say the late Michael Moseley because he was so full of life. Whenever you heard him or read him, and he was just fizzing with ideas. So apart from the TV and the podcasts, his breakthrough really, particularly for publishing, was his amazing diet books. And I have to say about diet books that, as I'm sure listeners know, they are a dime a dozen at New Year. You know, they are loads of them. The shelves are groaning with them. And really only the best stand out. You have to write a good one or promote it really well to have a best-selling diet book. And he had an absolute production line of them. So I'm sure we all remember The Fast Diet. That came out in 2013. And it introduced us to the 5-2 diet. Do you remember that? The 5 days on, 2 days off.
Yep.
And the switching to the more Mediterranean style of diet. It's difficult to relate how big that was in the UK. It kind of dominated all diet publishing for not only the first year, but in subsequent years of its life. It just came out and was got a new lease of life every year. I know dozens of people, you know, people at work, my friends who were doing it. He actually claimed to, Michael Moseley claimed to have reversed his type 2 diabetes by actually adopting a Mediterranean diet. But he had loads more international bestsellers, the 8-week blood sugar diet, the clever guts diet. And his most recent one was Just One Thing, which, of course, was based on his podcast and which became a Radio 4 series as well, about how sort of tiny changes to your working day, your living day, your diet, can even in your behavior, can make a huge difference. Huge Sunday Times bestseller again, translated into 11 languages. And an interesting statistic I found out after he had died was that his sales have been worth 13.6 million through UK bookshops alone. So clearly his biggest loss is the fact that he is no longer here and what that means to his family and friends, but he is a massive loss to the industry as well.
Yeah, that's an incredible amount of money, isn't it?
It really is.
Wow. Well, thank you very much, Guy Lloyd, International Sales Manager for Penguin Random House. Always great to have you with us on the show. And if listeners want to see what books are coming up by Penguin Random House, they can, of course, look on the website.
That's it. Just put Penguin Books into any search engine of your choice. I'm very confident we'll come up first.
Thank you, Guy.
Thanks very much, Hannah.
TRE.
Talk Radio Europe. The Book Programme. Presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now is Erenison Okoje. She's a Nigerian-British writer. Her debut novel, Butterfly Fish, was shortlisted for an Edinburgh International First Book Award. She's a fellow and vice chair of the Royal Society of Literature and is the co-presenter of the BBC's Novels That Shaped Our World podcast, Turn Up for the Books. She was awarded an MBE for services to literature in 2021. She's also the director and founder of Black to the Future. She's with us on the book show to talk about her much anticipated second novel. It's called Curandera. It explores the darker elements of shamanism, desire, betrayal, and friendship across time and dimensions. It's perfect for fans who love a mix of modern and contemporary fiction with a spiritual, religious, and fantasy twist. Welcome to the book show, Erenison.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm delighted to be joining you from a sunny London. And dare I say, I'm hoping that sunny weather lasts, at least for a couple of days.
Oh, that's so nice. You haven't had much of a summer yet, have you?
I know. It's been a bit tricky so far. We've had a bit of a damp summer so far. So, yeah, it bodes well to have a couple of days of sunshine.
Yes, nice. Well, I hope the sun continues. So tell me a little bit about your background and how you got into writing.
Yeah, so I've always been a voracious reader since I was a child. You know, I read everything from Roald Dahl to Toni Morrison to James Baldwin. I was just, once I discovered the world of books, I was hooked because I just loved the fact that it opened up my mind in so many interesting ways. But I also spent like the first 8 years of my life growing up in Nigeria. And during that time, I would go and see my grandmother, and there would often be tales around the fire, you know, these old folk tales that would change depending on who was telling the story. And those tales were often quite fantastical, often quite surreal, and often with a lesson at the heart of it. And that always kind of struck me. And I think I carried that in my marrow, really, in the bones, even when I moved to England, age 8. So from then on, I kind of was hooked on stories and storytelling and the ways we can tell stories. And throughout my 20s, I was still the same in that sense, even though I was, you know, doing different jobs. I studied law at university, interestingly enough. But behind the scenes, there was always that passion for writing and passion for literature. So I was always writing, whether it was poems, you know, diary entries, observing people, mini prose poems, essays. I was always turning my hand to something. And then in my late 20s, I started working for a performance poetry organization called Apples and Snakes, which is a live literature development organization. And I was programming poets around the country. And the interesting thing about that job is that it just really exposed you to so many different types of creative people, from writers to poets to illustrators to producers. So I was lucky in that sense that I think I was kind of part of this exciting subculture that was happening. And then at the same time, I applied for a development program with an organization called Spread the Word. And they were running a mentoring scheme for young writers to be paired up with established writers. And we would be mentored for a year. So through that, I started writing my debut novel. And I'm very lucky in that sense, I think, because I kind of came up in a grassroots way. And then through that process, I was able to keep developing the novel and then eventually get it out into the world.
Yeah, fantastic. So how does your second novel, Curandera, compare to Butterfly Fish? Are there similarities within them?
That's such a great question. I think they both look at complex women in really interesting ways. I loved writing Butterfly Fish. It was my debut novel, as you said, and I threw the kitchen sink at it. You know, I was very free in terms of the way I explored it. And it's a bit like a first album. You do it in a particular way. And then when you look back, you think, God, I'm not sure I could write that novel now because I didn't really know the rules, so to speak. But I think with Curandera, I think it's even more experimental, I would say. It's even, I think, darker and bolder than Butterfly Fish, perhaps. I think it's been a long time coming for me. You know, I've written 3 books, two of which were short story collections where I really was able to kind of explore my subversive voice. But with Curandera, it feels like the kind of amalgamation of all of that. So I'm super excited to have it coming out.
Yeah, nice. So tell us who or what is Curandera?
Yeah, so Curandera actually translates into the word shaman. And the book is about shamanism in different forms and shamanism across dimensions. And shamanism is essentially just a healer, really. You know, people who use healing, plantology, and are often, you know, embedded within communities where perhaps there's not often much support. So lots of indigenous communities have healers as well. So I was kind of like fascinated by that. And also because my late grandmother, who's now no longer with us, unfortunately, was massively into plants and using plants to kind of heal ailments. But I was thinking about the darker side of that and how that could manifest. So with Curandera, we have these two different time periods, present day London and 17th century Cape Verde, Cabo Verde. In modern day London, we have 4 individuals who are friends, and they're kind of fascinated with rituals and healings. But they're also on a secret mission, which I won't reveal and spoil for listeners. So that occupies that timeline. And then in the 17th century timeline, we have a mysterious woman who appears in this town. And she kind of infiltrates the town in really insidious ways. She's staying with a local fisherman for room and board, and sort of subtly starts to create tensions within the family. So not just within the micro, but within the macro as well. And then the two timelines start to sort of slowly spill into each other, hopefully in compelling ways.
Mm. So did you pick the 17th century for a particular reason?
Yeah, well, I'm kind of fascinated by African history. So part of Butterfly Fish was set in the 18th century kingdom of Benin. And Benin is where my family are from. And I remember my dad was always telling me stories about the Benin kingdom. And that really planted the seed for wanting to write Butterfly Fish. With Curandera, I had made a trip to Cape Verde in my early 20s, which was a fairly formative trip, really. I loved it so much. And I was really struck by how different it was to sides of Africa that are often presented. It was so interesting. And I thought I would love to write about this place someday, but a reimagined Cape Verde from the past, hence why I set the novel there.
Yeah. And can you tell us any more about the friends in present day London?
Well, yeah. I mean, how do I describe them? We have Therese, the main character there, who's a botanist, and she's kind of the leader of the pack. And then we have Azaka, who's a Haitian musician, you know, so he's also somebody that's a friend, also has his demons. We have Finn, who's a journalist and also expeditionist. And he has certain wounds that he's nursing. And then we have Emilian, who is very restless, but staying with them because of his connection to Therese, but he has secrets. So they all kind of bring their own baggage to the table, really, and there are tensions within that friendship group as well. But it was really lovely to kind of work on it and, you know, carry these characters in my head for several years, but also see them kind of come to life and during the writing process allow them to speak to me.
Yeah. And are they from different countries with very different backgrounds?
They are from different countries. So as I mentioned, Emilian is from South America. Finn is from the UK, but has an indigenous background. And then Azaka's from Haiti. So yeah, they're all from different backgrounds. And then Therese is British.
Nice. So did you have to do a bit of research into the different countries and the backgrounds and all that kind of thing?
Yes, I did. And I really enjoy researching. It's kind of hard not to fall down a rabbit hole with it. And I think you do for a little bit, but then you have to stop and go, right, I need to get on with the writing now. So that's always a fun part of the process.
Yeah. So now the second book is out there. Have you moved on to book three, or do you take a bit of a break?
So this will be book four, but will be the second novel. So this will make it two novels and two short story collections that I will have in the world. But I will have another book out soon, hopefully in the next 2 years. I have a book of essays that I'm working on, a book of hybrid essays just about, yeah, what it means to be a woman, what it means to be a Black woman and a woman of colour, exploring different things like trauma, love, desire, all of that good stuff, but within the essay form. And I think that probably feels a bit more vulnerable as well, because I am literally writing about my lived experiences.
Yeah.
It's very exposing for writers doing that. You never know how it's going to be received. Mm-hmm. But it's exciting for me because, yeah, this is a kind of another form that I'm interested in playing around with. So, yeah, it'd be lovely to have that come out when that's ready.
Yeah. And can you tell us a bit about the Black to the Future Festival?
Yeah, of course. So Black to the Future is an Afrofuturist festival that I started last year. We were working across multiple mediums, across film, across TV, across literature, across circus, theatre. And really the idea is to celebrate brilliant Black voices, especially the ones that are doing incredible things, but kind of on the fringes, and wanting to centre them more and really create a space where we're sort of introducing them to broader audiences, but also fostering a sense of community. And it's been really amazing, actually, because unlike most festivals, we've had the events over a year. So from October last year to now, like Black to the Future events are still running. And that's partly deliberate, but also partly because we've been kind of stunned by the level of interest in the projects and the level of support that we've had. We were very lucky to partner with the British Library, the Standard Hotel, the Garden Cinema, Christie's Auction House, who we're doing a couple of events with coming up. So it's been amazing, exhausting, but amazing. Yes.
Brilliant. And tell us a bit about this podcast. This sounds really interesting.
Oh, the podcast. Yeah. So the podcast was great. It was, we wrapped up about a year or so ago now, but it was literally just, talking about books with Dan Smith from Bastille, very famous man, and Simon Savage and I, just kind of talking about books, hopefully in a very accessible way. We're all like big book lovers. So when we got asked to do this project for the BBC, it was kind of a no-brainer. And it's really interesting being the only woman as well within the group, but it was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed it, and I would encourage people to listen to it. Actually, it's a very good podcast, if I do say so myself.
Yeah, great, good for you. Well, if people want to get a copy of Curandera, it's available on our website, tre.radio, and it's by Irenos and Akoje, who we've been chatting with today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's been a joy. Thank you so much for having me.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now is Robert Tregoning. He studied at the Glasgow School of Art before leaping into a career on the West End stage. He's appeared in shows including Charlie and the Chocolate Factory and Matilda the Musical. He's with us on the Book Show to talk about his debut novel, The Dress in the Window. It was inspired by his husband Billy and his childhood memory of falling in love with a dress in the shop. It's a powerful celebration of imagination, parental love, and being true to yourself. He wrote the book to celebrate difference and to encourage young children to feel free to express themselves. It, along with three others, has been picked by indie bookshops across the country as the best books of the summer, winning this year's Indie Book Awards. This is running as part of Independent Bookshop Week, which is from the 15th to the 22nd of June. Welcome to the show, Robert.
Hello. Thank you, Hannah. Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure. Thanks so much for joining us. And congratulations. How lovely.
Thank you. I still can't quite believe it's real.
I bet. So I love the kind of story behind this book. Tell us a little bit about it, can you?
Yeah. So, like you said, it's inspired by childhood memories, partly of my own. I used to love going to haberdasheries and looking at all of the fabrics and the buttons and the sequins and seeing the sort of the material draped around the mannequins and imagining the possibilities of what it could become. And like you said, the childhood memory of my husband, my amazing husband, Billy, he had a memory of walking past a dress shop every day on his way to school and just falling in love with the dresses in the window. And it was that image of a young boy with his nose pressed to the glass, sort of gazing at and longing for something that's just out of reach, that sparked the idea for this story, which is a celebration of self-expression and sparkles.
Oh, love it. And I mean, it's something we've talked about before on the radio, the idea that it's so wrong that you have kind of boys' toys and girls' toys and kind of putting kids into boxes. And these are the colours that you should be looking at and the kind of toys that you should be playing with. And as we all know, just talking from your own experience, you can't put kids into boxes, can you?
Of course not. Of course not. And that's so important to me. And with all of the books that I write, that's quite often at the forefront, that idea of challenging and breaking down gender stereotypes. Because I know growing up, they had a negative effect on me and they did lead to worry and to shame. That's why I feel it's so important that we tell stories like this. And like you say, we don't divide anything into categories and put children into boxes, because it's just nonsense.
Yeah. So tell us about the little boy in your story.
So he's walking down the high street with his mum when he spots this sparkling dress in the window. And it's love at first sight. And he feels his heart disco dancing when he looks at the sequins. And his imagination starts to wander. And he thinks about who could have worn the dress before, because it's in the window of a secondhand shop. And he thinks, could it be a movie star or a spy or a singer or a fashion model? And then mum suggests, you know, maybe if we save up some money, one day we could come back and buy it and that dress could be yours. And so that's it. Then nothing will stop him. It's his determination to go back and buy that dress. And he helps all of the neighbours, their lovely community that live around them. And eventually he saved up enough money. And they do head back to the high street. But will the dress still be in the window when they get there?
Brilliant. So tell us about the illustrations, because they're really beautiful. How did that come about?
So, yeah, I feel very fortunate to be working with some amazing artists on the picture books that I write. And in the case of The Dress in the Window, that's Pippa Koenig, who is an incredible illustrator. And it all happens through the publisher. They take the story and then they try and find the perfect person to illustrate it. And this really does feel like a perfect joining of images and text. Pippa has filled it with so much love and so much joy, and really like stitched the sparkle into the story as you turn from page to page. It's so, so beautiful.
Lovely.
There is a moment, not without giving anything away, there's a moment at the end when I first saw the way Pippa had brought it to life. It took my breath away and it really did move me to tears. It's just so joyful.
Oh, how lovely. And your other book is Out of the Blue. Is that I know, yeah, that's got a similar kind of message to it.
Yeah, so there are two other books out there currently, Out of the Blue and A Fairy Called Fred, and both of those are illustrated by a wonderful artist called Steph Murphy. Out of the Blue is talking through metaphor. It's actually talking a little bit about how it feels to carry a secret and then be able to let that secret go, and with the love of a parent, be able to live really openly and authentically and to find joy. And then A Fairy Called Fred is a twist on a fairy tale, because I grew up loving fairy tales and magical stories, but not always seeing myself reflected in the cast of characters as a young boy who loved all things stereotypically considered feminine. So A Fairy Called Fred is a twist on the Cinderella story, which is putting more of myself into it.
Yeah, nice. And it's so important, I suppose, as you obviously know from personal experience, for kids and young people to feel like they're represented in the books that they read. Otherwise, they grow up kind of feeling, well, you tell me. I mean, I grow up yeah, feeling really different and like you don't fit in, I suppose.
Absolutely. Yeah, from a young age, I remember having those feelings of, oh, something about me is different. Oh, exactly, I don't quite fit into this world around me. And my number one goal as an author is to write the stories that I wish I could have read as a young child. And I really hope they help children feel seen and understood and feel celebrated and just spread joy. My real number one goal as an author.
Yeah, nice. So tell us about these Indie Book Awards then and this Independent Bookshop Week.
Yeah, it's just unbelievable to be acknowledged by the Indie Book Awards and to see The Dress in the Window win this award has been amazing. And there's been so much love and support for the books from indie bookshops across the country. I believe the Indie Book Awards is voted for by indie bookshops across the UK and Ireland. And I've been lucky enough to visit lots of those bookshops over the last year. And I've always felt so welcomed and so supported. And we've run brilliant storytime sessions and brilliant events. And they really are just the best places to go and find books, are those wonderful indie bookshops on our high streets where the booksellers can really get to know the customers and know exactly what kind of thing you're looking for and really find the perfect books for you. So it's a real joy to be acknowledged by the indie booksellers.
Yeah, lovely. Well, if people listening want to find out more about the Indie Book Awards and previous winners, they can have a look on the booksaremybag.com website and click on Indie Book Awards. And there's lots of information on bookshop.org as well, and all over social media, Indie Bookshop Week and Indie Book Awards. And if people want to get a copy of The Dress in the Window, it's available on our website, tre.radio, and it's by Robert Tregoning, who we've been chatting with today. Robert, thank you so much for joining us, and congratulations.
Thank you so much, Hannah. It's been a pleasure.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray. Talk Radio Europe. The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Good evening. Welcome to the second part of tonight's book show. In the first hour, we were chatting to Guy Lloyd, Irinason Okoje, and Robert Tregoning. In this hour, we're joined by Jo Thomas, whose debut novel, The Oyster Catcher, was a runaway bestseller and won both the RNA Joan Hessian Award and the Festival of Romance Best Ebook Award. Jo loves to explore new countries and discover the food produced there, both of which she thoroughly enjoys researching. Love in Provence is a follow-up to her number one bestseller, Escape to the French Farmhouse. Also chatting to Dan Flanagan, who holds a PhD in history. His first published book was his PhD dissertation, The Criminal Law of Slavery and Freedom, 1800 to 1868. He moved on from academia to serve the civil rights cause as a school desegregation lawyer, followed by a long career as a finance attorney in private law practice. An American Tragedy is book four in the Peter O'Keefe series and goes back to the late 80s when a frenzy of satanic panic gripped the nation. Also chatting to Gay Maris, a retired research scientist whose career focused on insect ecology, parasites and honeybee health. Her debut novel, The Curtain Twitcher's Book of Murder, is set in the deceptively dangerous suburbs of 1960s London, where she grew up. Finally, we chat to Karen Fitzgibbon, an actor, producer, director and writer whose debut novel, The World's End, is set in coastal Ireland and is the first in a new series featuring private investigator Lana Bowen. And that's tonight's book show on Talk Radio Europe.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Depends in my hand, ending unplanned. Staring at the blank page before you, open up the dirty window, let the sun illuminate the words that you could not find. Reaching for something in the distance, so close you can almost taste it. Release your inhibitions, feel the rain on your skin. No one else can feel it for you.
Joining us on the line now is Jo Thomas. She worked for many years as a reporter and producer, including time at Radio 4's Woman's Hour and Radio 2's The Steve Wright Show. Her debut novel, The Oyster Catcher, was a runaway bestseller and won both the RNA Joan Hessian Award and the Festival of Romance Best Ebook Award. Jo loves to explore new countries and discover the food produced there, both of which she thoroughly enjoys researching. She's back with us on the book show to talk about her latest novel, Love in Provence. It's a follow-up to her number one bestseller, Escape to the French Farmhouse. Welcome to the book show, Jo.
Thank you for having me back, Hannah.
Oh, it's lovely to have you with us. So you decided to do a follow-up. Why did you want to stick with the characters from Escape to the Farmhouse?
This is the first time I've done a follow-up. This is going to be, I think, what do we say, book 17? 17. And the first time I thought, oh, I'd like to do a follow-up. And people were just asking me about the characters in Escape to the French Farmhouse. And I thought, you know, I have got a story for these guys. With the harvest coming round, I wanted to get back into the lavender fields there. And when I'm writing it, you know, it really feels like I'm there in the heat and amongst the lavender fields. And so I just thought, well, why not? Let's have a go. You know, the audience are asking for it. So let's go back and visit Del and Fabienne in France, in Provence, and see what's happening and what mischief the Mistral can make.
Yeah. So how did you find it then, doing a sequel for the first time? What was it like? Did it feel different? Did it feel easier?
It's funny enough, it is very different from writing something from scratch, because you just kind of like, you know, you've got to be correct in your facts, you know, who's called what and what animals they have and how many children they have. But it's lovely because it's like building a Bible of characters, you know, of where they exist and really, really getting more and more into their characters and their backstory and where they are in life.
Yeah. So tell us about the characters then that you've returned to.
Well, it's based on Del, who moved out there. We're 3 years on from when she first moved out. Actually, not first moved out, because if you've read Escape to the French Farmhouse, you'll know that it starts on moving day. But it's not moving day moving out to France. It's leaving France. She's moved out there with her husband. They were going to go and live the French dream. And 6 months later, it's all gone pear-shaped. And she realizes on moving day that it's not her husband. It's not France that's the problem. It's her and her husband. And so she decides to stay in an empty house with only her dog for company. And she's no idea what she's going to do. But going back to the UK and back to where they started is not the answer. So she stays on in France. And we're now 3 years on, where she has she found a cookery book in the Brocante all about lavender cookery. And that was her way through in the last book, of actually coping every day. She would bake every day from this cookery book that involved lavender. And now she's started to bring the lavender farm back to life, you know, and so the lavender is in full bloom and we're coming up to the harvest. And the Mistral sweeps in again, turning her world on its head for her and her lovely partner, Fabienne.
So did you have to do lots of research eating baked goods with lavender in?
Yes, and drinking rosé wine and sitting a bit in Provence, you know, under the sunshine, soaking it all up, just so I could really take my readers there. It's very hard, nice. Anna.
Yeah, someone's got to do it. I love the idea of cakes with lavender. It's quite unusual, isn't it?
You have to be quite light-handed with lavender, because if you put too much in, it can be overpowering. But lavender, of course, is one of the herbs in Herbes de Provence. You know, Herbes de Provence is everything that grows naturally in and around Provence. And so that is one of the actual ingredients in Herbes de Provence. It's what sort of differs it from Italian herb mixes,
right.
Is the of lavender in there. So, you know, but lamb with lavender, you know, with the Herbes de Provence, gorgeous. And some Dauphinois potatoes with cream and sliced onion bubbling. That's what I'm thinking of for tomorrow's dinner.
Oh, lovely. So not just sweet things then. You can use it a lot in savoury cooking.
Absolutely. You know, in things like your ratatouille or your bouillabaisse, at the back of the book, they're recipes. And they're just things that I would make in my kitchen, really. And, you know, they all include things like the lavender, because they are in Herbes de Provence. And as I say, I would use that in ratatouille, in bouillabaisse, in lamb, as well as there's a lovely recipe for banana and lavender cake in here as well. So there's some recipes at the back there, so that once you finish the story, you can hang on to a little taste of Provence for a little bit longer.
Yeah, love it. So tell us about Fabienne.
Oh, well, Fabien is, he runs the local brocante, of course. but he also, in his younger days, he was part of a band. And those days are gone, really, because he's settled now. He's living with Del. And he's kind of a sort of surrogate father and grandfather to a young woman, Stephanie, who has come into Del's life and she's taken her under her wing. So he actually gets the chance to rejoin his old band just for one last tour. And he's deciding whether or not he can actually go off and do that. And Del realizes that you've got to take your moments in life. You can't go on with regrets. You know, the only things that you regret in life are the things that you don't do. So she is very much behind him in telling him to go off, pick up his guitar and go off and do one last summer of festivals and events with the band.
Great fun. And have you definitely decided that there will not be a follow-up to this one, or could there be more from these characters?
I think there could be one more from these guys. I think there could be one more back to Provence for one final story.
Oh, lovely. And are you already starting on that one, or do you have a break and go on to a different book?
No, I have just finished the copy edits and getting everything ready for the Christmas book, which is Christmas in the Swiss Alps. And as you know, all my books have food at the heart of them. So this one is lavender. You know, I've done olive oil, I've done oysters. This one has been a long time coming. This one, for Christmas, we've got chocolate in Switzerland and a tiny little chocolate school up in the mountains. So that one is ready to go. And I'm writing next summer, which is back in Italy. It's not a follow-on, it's a new one, but it's in Italy. So I've got a couple to go before I can think about doing the next follow-on for the gang in Provence.
Yeah, oh, lovely. And did you, please tell me you had to eat lots of chocolate when writing the chocolate book?
Of course, of course. And actually, you know, if you go to somewhere like Geneva, and I've always said that once you find the food of a place, you really do find, you know, the history of the place, how the community runs, the personalities there. And you go to Geneva and you can do wonderful, wonderful walking chocolate tours that take you all around the city and tell you all about the history of the city through chocolate history, really, and the chocolate shops there. So you pop into the chocolate shops and you find out, you know, say the whole history of the area and its proud, proud ownership of its role in the chocolate that we eat today and the master chocolatiers. It's fascinating. So I wanted to bring all this into one book where it's, as I say, this small chocolate school, but where the knives are very much out.
Yes, fantastic. And I love, as usual, you've got lots of lovely quotes from fellow romantic authors, the likes of Jill Mansell, Philippa Ashley, Sue Moorcroft. I love how you all support each other. It's so nice.
We are very much a gang, you know, because people don't just buy one romantic novel a year. If you enjoy romantic novels, you know, you'll buy, you know, quite a few. And you're interested in, if you like one author, you'll be interested to hear of other ones that you might recommend. And we just had a lovely week away, in fact. There was Jill Mansell, Katie Ford, Millie Johnson, Leslie Pierce. You know, we tend to go away for writing retreats and, you know, spend some time together because it's, you know, otherwise we're writing on our own.
Yeah.
And we go and have some time and write and chat and I cook and we drink and have a lovely time.
Oh, that sounds wonderful. So do you, I mean, can it be difficult because you're all writing in a similar sort of genre? If you're talking about writing, it must be difficult to kind of not give too much away because you don't want to go, oh, I'm doing this at the moment, and then someone to think, oh, that's a good idea. Do you have to be kind of careful how much you share? Not that you take each other's ideas in intentionally, obviously.
No, not at all. It's like when Katie Ford and I get in the car, we go on a road trip just to talk storylines. You know, I've got this idea, you know, and we find it by the end of the road trip. And we've been doing road trips together for years, research trips together. And as soon as we get in the car, then, you know, everyday life just sort of melts away. and we are just working out storylines. And it's very much the same with the others. And we all write very different types of stories. And if someone said something, and someone might go, oh, that's an idea for a story. And if you are working on that, you go, just for everyone to know, that's what I'm writing next, you know? So actually being more open, you know.
Yeah, that's really nice. Well, if people want to get a copy of Love in Provence, it's available now on our website, tre.radio, and it's by Joe Thomas, who we've been chatting with today. Joe, thanks so much for joining us. Lovely to chat again.
Oh, thank you, Hannah. Take care.
Hello, little Alan Bennett here. If I'm not writing books, then the thing I like most is listening to the book club on Talk Radio Europe. Fancy.
Joining us on the line now is Dan Flanagan. He holds a PhD in history. His first published book was his PhD dissertation, The Criminal Law of Slavery and Freedom, 1800 to 1868. He moved on from academia to serve the civil rights cause as a school desegregation lawyer, followed by a long career as a finance attorney in private law practice. He's with us on the book show to talk about his latest novel, An American Tragedy. It's book four in the Peter O'Keefe series. Welcome to the book show, Dan.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for joining us. It sounds like a fascinating and diverse career that you've had.
Yes, I guess I just need to keep moving around.
Is there a particular part that you've really, really enjoyed when you look back at all the different things that you've done?
You know, it's funny. I decided when I was a sophomore in high school that I wanted to be a, quote, writer. And that stayed with me forever and made a lot of my life unnecessarily unhappy. But finally, I actually, after putting myself and my wife through more trouble than we deserved, and than she deserved, certainly, I just gave it up. And spent 20 pretty happy years as a lawyer, and now I'm pretty happy being able to get back to it at a time when, for one reason or another, I'm not sure what it is, maybe just having a lot of life behind me, is being able to pursue this writing very seriously now.
Yeah. So tell us about your character, Peter O'Keefe.
Yes, this series begins in 1986. O'Keefe is in his mid-30s at that point. He's a, you know, 60s guy, dropped out of college, ended up in Vietnam, comes back, gets married, divorced, daughter that he sometimes is a decent father to, cocaine and alcohol addiction. His best childhood friend is a lawyer. And he sort of pulls him up out of the sewer, if you will, and says, I'm going to make a private detective out of you, whether you like it or not. And so O'Keefe goes along with it rather reluctantly. And so the first book, called Mink Eyes, it's in 1986. He's you know, trying to build this business, if you will, and gets himself in trouble with the mafia. This notion behind this series is that we start in 1986 and follow O'Keefe and this group of characters through their lives, really, which is also the history of our times in a way, and trying to kind of explore ways that these private lives intersect with big public events. And so now we're in 1988. It took me fourth book. I've only managed 2 years so far. But 1988, he's trying to build his business, but finds himself drawn into what in the U.S. at that time was a very serious thing, which was a sort of intersection of two different things: the satanic panic, so-called, and a related moral panic about child sexual abuse.
That was big at the time, was it? Was that what was going on in the late 80s?
Yes. I mean, some people really call it a witch hunt. And there were several spectacular sort of trials, and some people that most people who studied it regard as innocent ended up with long prison sentences and so on. It doesn't mean that there wasn't child abuse. It's just that the focus of it just turned hysterical.
Wow, interesting. So does it seem that people went to jail who weren't guilty of it then?
Yes, that's what most people believe. You know, it's typical of a large public controversy like that, where you have people on both sides of it, but pretty much the overwhelming evidence of all those who've investigated it think that quite a number of people were convicted wrongfully.
Wow!
And a whole sort of reform movement developed in terms of how to deal with children in these situations, and instead of really almost putting things in their head, a form of brainwashing, a method of I'll call it interrogation. It's not, that's too strong of a word, but interviewing children in these situations, and a whole different protocol was developed in the 80s, 90s, and beyond. That's in place today, and people feel like, anyway, that there's it's a much fairer, safer thing, more designed to get to the truth of what happened.
Wow, how interesting. So have the families of the people who were put away been campaigning and things ever since?
Yes, and they've had their own advocates, you know, everything from private lawyers through journalists and scholars who've, you know, taken up the cause. Really, in the 1990s, it really, let's call it a backlash to the backlash, began, you know, quite a few publications, you know, both in the press and at a book level and so on, you know, getting into the cases. But there are still people in jail that a whole lot of people regard as innocent. I mean, some of the prison sentences were incredibly long.
Gosh, and how, I mean, it's obviously a complicated situation, but how is it that so many people think they're innocent, but yet they're still in jail?
Well, it's, you know, it's very hard to overturn a conviction once it happens. And there has to be pretty much overwhelming support. And so you end up at a probation hearing with really two sides there still. I mean, there's still people who strongly believe those people are guilty. So it can be very difficult for especially a politician to provide any relief. Although there's been enough. I mean, the courts of appeal turned over a number of these convictions, and you know, other people's sentences were commuted and that sort of thing. And not to minimize the problem of child sexual abuse. I mean, I personally am on the board of World Childhood, which is a worldwide organization whose mission is to try to eradicate child sexual abuse internationally. But this is just shows sort of the other side of how you could go too far and really end up in a witch hunt kind of atmosphere. Yeah, at the same time, by the way, there's this satanic panic going on. And a lot of times these two things intersected. So you had these people being accused of devil worship as well as sexual abuse of children. And the satanic stuff was really crazy.
Yeah, gosh. And is that something that has kind of been, was it very much like of its time? I mean, I still feel like people are still talking about these things even now.
Well, yes. I mean, it just seems to pop up. You know, we have QAnon here now. that's, you know, has a conspiratorial, wild child sexual abuse accusation sort of thing going on. The satanic part is not strong as it was back then. But, you know, these things tend to recur somewhat, but it's not, and I'm not saying there aren't people unjustly accused and unjustly convicted of these things today, but it's not like it was back in the 80s and early 90s.
Mm. So when you created the character of Peter O'Keefe and wrote the first book, had you planned that you were going to turn it into a series, or has that just developed over time?
Not at all. I wrote the first draft of the first book in the 1980s. I was just writing a sort of coming of age story, late coming of age. I decided I should make this more interesting than just, you know, navel gazing kind of thing. And so I put it in this detective crime format, really just to try and hook people more into the whole thing. And then it's only later that I thought, well, you know, this, we could use this and really try to tell the history of our times in a way. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. It's more satisfying me to write something that's realistic, but still, you know, has some actual plots and, you know, action going on.
Yeah. And is it ongoing? Are there more books to come with O'Keefe?
Yes. I as long as I can keep at it and keep coming up with ideas, which really isn't that hard, but I don't know where we'll go. I'm at the beginning stage of working on number 5 now, so we've got that going.
Yeah. And would it give too much away to tell us a bit about the title of this book, An American Tragedy?
Usually when you have a tragedy, you have a tragic hero, the flawed type thing. But in this case, the tragic hero is America and what it was going through and the flaws in the justice system and in the therapy profession as well at that time. And without giving away the plot, it involves a trial that O'Keefe is sort of dragooned into. His daughter, his daughter's favorite teacher ever, one of her preschool teachers, is accused of this, and she says, "Dad, you got to help her." And he's much more interested in trying to build his profitable private detective practice, but agrees to do this, and then that story is really the story of the trial. But in a lot of ways, it's a courtroom drama.
Mm. It's exciting courtroom dramas, you know, reading them, watching them. What's it like to be involved in them?
Yeah, well, it's not so. First of all, I've been able to use a lot of my legal experience in coming up with plots and everything else. I was a finance lawyer, bankruptcy, financial scams, you know, all that kind of thing. And not that I participated in it, but it's just a fallout from it.
Yeah.
But I was not a criminal defense lawyer. So I have to really get smart and research a lot and consult my colleagues and everything else to make sure I got it right. I don't want to be one of those things that I do all the time when I'm watching Law and Order or something going, that had never happened.
Yes, exactly.
So I have to work at it. And so I don't have that life experience on the criminal defense side, but obviously it's got to be. I mean, any trial is extremely intense, and just takes everything you have while it's going on. And it's got to be even more so when your client's life is at stake.
Yeah, for sure. Well, if people want to get a copy of book four in the Peter O'Keefe series, it's called An American Tragedy. It's out now and available to buy on our website, tre.radio. And it's by Dan Flanagan, who we've been chatting with today. Dan, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now is Dr. Gay Maris. She is a retired research scientist whose career focused on insect ecology, parasites and honeybee health. She's with us on the book show to talk about her debut novel, The Curtain Twitcher's Book of Murder. It's set in the deceptively dangerous suburbs of 1960s London, where she grew up. Welcome to the book show, Gay.
Hi, thanks, Hannah. Lovely to be here. Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure. It's lovely to have you with us. And congratulations on your debut novel.
I am pinching myself. It's been a long time coming and I'm really, really excited. Yeah.
Oh, how nice. So where did you get the idea from for this book? Has that been brewing for a while as well?
Do you know, I couldn't put my finger on exactly when the idea was born. I took early retirement and I started writing fiction for pleasure because it was something I could fit in around complicated things going on, you know, at home. So I've started writing these short stories and I realized that each one was set in a particular property and these houses almost took on characters of their own. And it occurred to me that obviously if you put a row of houses together, you make a street. And so chapter by chapter, the book is constructed around the houses on a street. And so there wasn't any one moment when I made this decision. It sort of evolved.
Yeah. So we really get to know all the different people and families living on this street.
Yes. Yeah, you do. So, I mean, in essence, that the street outwardly seems very respectable and it's a quiet residential street, but in London, as you said, but chapter by chapter, it moves from house to house. And what I tried to do was lay bare the occupants' private lives so that the reader sees absolutely everything that's going on. They've got kind of a ringside seat to bad things. So these bad things, without spoilers, you know, there are murders and tragic suicide and people go missing, but the reader is seeing everything, but the occupants of the street see nothing or they explain it away. So it's kind of exploring and expanding on the on this idea that good neighbors keep themselves to themselves. And so I'd like to think it's not so much a whodunit, it's kind of like a why done it. You know who done it, but you learn more about why.
Yeah, interesting. So tell us about this street. Where in London have you set it? Is it a particular area you had in mind?
Well, I grew up in southwest London in what was then called Middlesex. And I think that the street is a kind of composite character of the kinds of streets I grew up in. So my home suburb, my hometown was Teddington. But back in the day, there were lots of Teddingtons, lots of high streets, like the high street that I refer to as well in the story. And I'm not sure human nature's changed particularly, but since the 1960s. But I think perhaps, you know, the way of life doesn't exist anymore in quite the same way, I think.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Well, I'm not familiar with Teddington, but I grew up near there, Harrow.
Oh, yeah. So you know, I don't know if you've had a chance to read the book, but Harrow, there are definitely streets in Harrow that would resemble the street in my mind's eye. Definitely.
Brilliant. Mm-hmm. So can you tell us about some of the characters?
Right. Okay. So each chapter begins with the line, from a distance, it's easy to mistake so-and-so for such and such a. And so the first character in the book is a little old lady, and it's taking apart this idea that just because you are old and you look sweet, that you actually are sweet. And that if you get up close and could hear or see what her unfortunate grown-up daughter can hear and see, you would view it through a different lens. So that's one character. There's a pair of very competitive twins. My own personal favourite character is a lady called Trixabel Cartwright, who is very much larger than life, and I admire her for her. I won't give anything away, but I'm kind of rooting for her in a bad way, I suppose. But the characters in the book that offer continuity and perhaps the voice of reason are the vicar and his wife, and they appear in every chapter, and the reader is shown their interpretation of, you know, suppose somebody's gone missing. Well, did he go on a cruise? He must have, you know, this kind of idea. And so they are there representing the what they believe to be the moral high ground, and they think they see everything with absolute clarity. But in fact, of course, they don't. And the vicar's wife in particular tends to make things worse rather than better.
So is the story told from lots of different points of view?
Yeah. So I try not to mix it up so it's too clunky or anything, but the reader gets to see what's happening through each player's eyes. So if you have more than one player in a chapter, you're going to see more than one point of view. Yeah.
Interesting. And was that confusing for you? Or I guess it's kind of makes sense when you're looking at all the different characters, seeing things from different points of view.
I sound so random. I didn't set out with a plan to have lots of points of view. And I became aware as I was offering it to others to read, as I was going along, that, you know, sometimes multiple points of view can be problematic for some reasons, but some readers. But I mean, it came naturally to me to write it that way. But also, given that what I'm really trying to do is get into the nitty gritty of why people do things, I kind of had to give the characters their own voices to explain. You hear their own reflections, and it's very difficult to do that if you're in somebody else's point of view, I think.
Yeah, definitely. And how about you with the writing? Once you started writing the novel and were getting into the flow of it, did you write quite regularly at particular times of the day? Or
I find it really interesting to talk to other people who write about the process. I mean, for me, I have to be disciplined, and I try and write something every day, otherwise I lose momentum. I found it when I was first writing, seriously, when I was really determined to complete this first book, I struggled. I think, honestly, it was because I was working at home and I started it pre-lockdown. So remembering pre-lockdown, pre-pandemic, not everybody was used to the idea of working at home. And so I think, because I was sitting at a coffee table with a cup of tea a lot of the time and was staring into space, I looked available to other family members who might come in the room when I'm actually, you know, trying to get down and write. Because so I've had to be disciplined not only in creating a space, a literal space where I can work, where I've tidied a place I can put my computer, but I've had to be disciplined in saying, no, I'm going to shut myself away for X many hours a day, and I'm going to get this many words done. And it's nobody's fault but my own if I didn't, you know, churn it out. That's what. But I'm writing another book at the moment, and I'm having all the same struggles with discipline that I had on the first one. I think, you know, some people, I'm in awe when people say, oh, you know, I got the first manuscript done. You know, it took me ages. I did it in 3 months. And I think, what?
Yes. It is unbelievable, isn't it? I don't understand how, well, I mean, I guess it's time management, but, you know, there are some people who, yeah, obviously it seems to be in their blood, and they juggle like 10 different things at once.
Indeed. I'm not, you know, I'm in awe of people like that, and I'm not one of them. Yeah.
No, fair enough. Neither am I. So where did you get the idea for the title from? I like it.
Oh, I'm glad you like the title. I wish I could say it was all my idea. My working title a while back was simply APRA Avenue, but the title as it is now went through various incarnations, and it had input from my fantastic agent, Eugenie Furness. I had input from Helen Corner Bryant at Cornerstone's Literary Agency. I had input from my publisher, and it is now a Curtin Twitchers Book of Murder. At one time, it was a Curtin Twitchers Guide to Macaroons and Murder. Yeah, it's had various forms. They're all cleverer than my initial idea.
Oh, I like it. So what is next for you then? Are you already on to the next book?
So I completed a sequel to this, to the current, the debut book. Some of the characters live to fight another day, and there are some new characters, but the vicar and his wife, you know, they're still there. But I'm currently working on a different project, which involves, guess what, a retired zoologist. And it's all from one point of view, and it's got a more conventional story arc, like in the old, you know, a traditional Agatha Christie type amateur sleuth, so that you have this, yes, as I say, a continuous story arc, and then I hope a denouement where she solves everything and the reader is amazed. But it's her connection with the natural world and animal behaviour that helps her to solve the crime or crimes.
Yeah, nice. And they say write what you know, so it's nice that you've got that zoology aspect in there.
Mm-hmm.
Has that been
I think
fun?
You're on a hiding to nothing if you write what you write what you don't know, or you have to do a lot of learning first.
Yeah. Mm. Has it been fun then writing in a kind of area of expertise that you're familiar with?
Oh, I just distract myself so much because I get into the detail of there's a thread of examples around animal behavior and or just interesting things about wildlife and how they make her see the world, this character. And so I've been researching, you know, every little line I write about this creature does that. And I think, oh gosh, I need to just look up my facts on that. And I really get just, you know, I can spend happy, happy hours learning about the sensilion and Midge's antennae or something, and then I sort of realised this, but this really isn't advancing the word count terribly. But I'm enjoying myself doing that.
Yes, yeah. Nice. Well, if people want to get a copy of your debut novel, A Curtin Twitchers Book of Murder, it's available now. It's on our website, tre.radio, and it's by Gay Maris, who we've been chatting with today. Gay, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you, Hannah. I've loved it, really. Thank you so much.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now is Karen Fitzgibbon. She's an actor, producer, director, writer and educator based in Limerick City. She's been co-writing, co-producing, directing and performing in plays and short films with community and professional groups for over 15 years. She's with us on the book show to talk about her debut novel, The World's End. It's the first in a new series introducing private investigator Lana Bowen. Welcome to the book show, Karen.
Thank you so much.
Oh, it's great to have you with us. And congratulations, your debut novel.
Yeah. It's been a very exciting time. I still can't believe it, actually. When I see it, I walk past a bookshop and I see it in a shelf. I still can't believe it. None of my family can. So, yeah, been very nice.
Yes, lovely. So before we talk about the book, tell us a little bit about your acting and directing theatre background.
Probably all began when I was early teens, when I attended a theatre school in my hometown. And I just fell in love with, you know, creating characters and being on stage and all of that sort of world where you just get to get lost and be somebody else for a while. And the rehearsals of it, I suppose my favourite part has always been the rehearsals, because that's when all the real creativity happens. So that's where it began. And then the years passed on and I attended an adult class. And at the end of that term, a group of us from that class decided to set up a theatre company, and we started producing theatre in Limerick. And we did an awful lot of work back in those years. It's a very, very different thing when you're producing theatre to just acting and just getting on stage, you know? So if you just act, you just got your script, you learn your lines, you come to rehearsals, it's just, that's pretty much it. But producing is a whole other experience. So we had to learn on the job.
Yeah.
But it was fun.
So you don't do that now?
Not so much. I do work with, about 15 years ago, I moved into community theatre with my work. So I started writing, co-writing with community groups. So we'd all sit around the table and one of us might have an idea for a play, I suppose. And then we would just brainstorm and devise. They might improvise. I'd put it all together. And in a matter of maybe 4 to 6 weeks, we'd have a script. So then we'd start rehearsing it. We'd stage it in a local theatre here in Limerick. And then a year later, we'd start all over again, you know. And then I work with a few different groups, so we all have a kind of a similar format. But each play is unique and it's new and it's, you know, everyone in the room adds to it. So I suppose writing a novel then was a very, very different sort of a medium for me because I was on my own. Very much.
Yeah. So did it feel weird? Were you quite kind of lonely working on your own?
Yes. Yeah. I felt like I'd left the band and I was going solo, you know. That's the only way I can describe it. You know, even when you're doing interviews, you always do them with your peers. But no, it's just me on my own now. But I found I actually love it. I just love just being lost, creating characters and stories. And, you know, sometimes you look at the screen and you have no idea what you're going to write. And then something comes to you and off you go. Yeah. And it's kind of just like that.
So why did you decide to create a series from the outset?
That happened as I was writing The World's End. Initially, I had no intention of doing that at all. You know, like the book, I had an idea for a book for a very long time to set it in sort of a coastal town in this luxurious summer house, and that a group of people would go there all trying to escape something that was troubling in their own personal lives. So that's what I wanted. I wanted these people to go to this beautiful house and stay there. And then on the last day, they hire a boat and sail out to an island, but they don't all come back. So something happens on the island. So I always knew the book was going to get that far, but I had no idea what was going to happen next. So just one day, the character of Lana Bowen just popped into my head. You know, someone has to solve this. Someone has to find out what happened. And the more I wrote about her, the more I liked her. And I thought, maybe this girl has got legs. Maybe she can come back again in another book. And she has, and she does. She's back in 2 and 3. They're all standalone novels, but her story continues. She has got her own trauma from an event that happened in her professional life where she made a mistake and she suffers panic attacks. And, you know, but so that's what made her move into private investigation so she could, you know, kind of pick and choose what she does.
Mm. So do we like her? Is the idea that the readers are kind of rooting for her?
Yes, I do. I think people will identify her. When someone has something that, like, they're not perfect, she's not perfect. And when someone is like that, I think we can all identify because, you know, we as humans, we are flawed. You know, there's always something that isn't right or we might think isn't right about ourselves or we struggle with, you know. So I think for that reason, people will identify with her and like her.
Yeah.
You know? And she kind of does things her own way as well, which is always also quite interesting. Something I discovered as I was writing that she's quite a strong headed character.
Yeah.
And won't be told what to do sort of thing.
And what about her personal life?
Yes. So she's an only child and her father has passed away. So she's living in an apartment, but her mom comes and visits a lot. They have a great relationship. They're very, very, very close. But the mom is going through something. She's beginning to get forgetful about little things. But Lana's so busy, she doesn't usually notice the signs at the beginning. So yeah, that's her personal life. And of course, there's no love interest because she's so, so busy. But something does happen towards the end of the novel to change all that.
Yeah, nice. So what can you tell us about the setting then and why it's called The World's End?
Yeah, so the setting is, like, in my head, it's a few different little coastal towns in Ireland all put together. You know, it's the perfect coastal town, but I don't think it exists. If it does, I'd love to know where it is. So it's, you know, you've got a lovely harbour, you've got a pier, you've got a beautiful beach and a boutique hotel, and then you've got this incredibly stunning, luxurious summer house. And the summer house is called The World's End. And the summer house faces the sea, and it also faces this island called Mutton Island. So yeah, that's where the whole setting is. So in my head, it was kind of like, I'm not sure if you're usually familiar with Ireland, but there's a beautiful place in Cork called Cove, mm-hmm. but there's Kinsale. You know, there's lots of different little coastal towns, and they all have little bits of this fictitious coastal town called Castle Cove. Nice. And it's a lovely place to go, really nice place to go. So this holiday home is where they stay. One of the holidaymakers has, he's acquainted with the owner of this house. But I can't tell you why.
So without giving too much away, can you tell us a little bit about what happens in the book in terms of the kind of crime aspect?
Yes. So there's five friends. Two are in a relationship, and the others then are sort of connected with each of those two, you know. So there's two girls and three guys, and they all stay in this beautiful house. So one girl is going out with the guy who has acquired this house for the weekend, shall we say. So she's single mom, crazy in love, has had bad luck in her love life, and is just, you know, jumping head over heels into this relationship. And she brings along her friend, and the friend then meets one of the other guys on the weekend, but he is... he's already in a married relationship. So something sparks between the two of them. And then there's another guy who has a whole other reason for being there. God, it's hard to actually tell the story without telling the story. Does that make any sense?
You're doing all right. You're doing all right.
Okay.
So they're all friends and they're kind of on holiday together.
So they're kind of friends, acquaintances. Like, some of them don't know each other at all. Right. But they all have something going on in their personal life. Like Grace, she is the girl who something terrible happens to her. And so she has got a mom she visits her in a nursing home before she goes away for the weekend. And her mom has this terrible reaction to her every time she sees her. So we find out later in the book why that actually happens. But she's really upset, and she feels rejected by her mom, and it's repeatedly happening, but yet she keeps going back to see her. So that's her reason for wanting to get away. And then there's this Stephen character. He's the man who's married, and he also has something traumatic that's happened in his past. So he desperately wants to get away, because every day with living with his wife is a constant reminder. And then there's Sarah, who's the single mom. And then there's the other two, who I really can't tell you anything about, because...
Fair enough.
Yeah, but they're there for a reason. They're there for a reason. But they all want to get down there. They all have a reason for being in The World's End or for staying there.
Okay. And you mentioned book two and three. Have you already written them?
Yes, I have. So I'm literally in the process of doing edits on book two at the moment. Book three, early stages of edits for that one. So, but yeah, book two, I'm not sure when it's going to come out, if it's this side of Christmas or the new year.
Yeah.
But it takes Lana to London. She travels to London. There's so it's about a woman she visits her daughter in college, and because the daughter has kind of gone a little bit quiet in radio contact and acting a bit strange. So she visits her in Belfast in college. And when she gets there, she discovers the daughter has had a baby. So she brings her home to Limerick. And when they're at the train station, the mother is holding the baby, and her daughter, she turns around and her daughter's disappeared. So that's the start of that story.
Yeah, great. Well, for the meantime, if listeners want to get a copy of The World's End, it's available now on our website, tre.radio, and it's by Karen Fitzgibbon, who we've been chatting with today. Karen, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
The TRE Book Show is sponsored by audible.co.uk. Download one title each month, plus unlimited listening to thousands of Audible originals, podcasts and audiobooks. Just click on the Audible banner at www.tre.radio.
You've been listening to a TRE production. If you've enjoyed this programme, there'll be another episode waiting for you next week, right here on this platform, where you can also access our extensive back catalogue of shows and interviews. For more information on our live programming, social media channels and apps, and how to contact Talk Radio Europe, please visit tre.radio.